This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. As the United States scales back its military presence across the Middle East to focus on great power competition with China and Russia, it risks giving those two countries a chance to fill the gap and expand their influence around the Gulf. That's according to the U.S. commander for the region on Sunday. While traveling through the Middle East over the past week, Marine General Frank McKenzie, who heads the U.S. Central Command, fielded a persistent question from the military and political leaders he met, and that is the U.S. still committed to their country and the region, and what more support can they get? Israeli police escorted more than 250 Jewish visitors to a Flashpoint holy site in Jerusalem, where police actions in recent weeks had ignited protests and violence that helped trigger war in Gaza. Those overseeing the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound said that the police cleared young Palestinians out of the site and barred entry to Muslims under the age of 45. It says six Palestinians were arrested, with four later released. Israeli police denied there was any age restriction and said they arrested five people who violated the public order. It said the site was open for regular visits. A ceasefire halted the 11-day Gaza war early Friday. The UN said hundreds of homes in Gaza were completely destroyed. India's COVID-19 tally rose to more than 26,530,000, with more than 240,000 new cases registered within a 24-hour period, according to the Federal Ministry of Health and Family Welfare Sunday. In a bid to curb the COVID-19 cases graph, most of the states in the country have imposed night curfews and partial or complete lockdowns. This is VOA News. Torrents of lava poured into villages after dark in eastern Congo, with little warning, leaving at least 15 people dead amid the chaos and destroying more than 500 homes. That's according to both officials and survivors. The eruption of the volcano Saturday night sent about 5,000 people fleeing from the city of Goma across the nearby border to Rwanda, while another 25,000 others sought refuge to the northwest. The UN Children's Agency said this on Sunday, and more than 170 children were still feared missing. And UNICEF officials said that they were organizing transit centers to help unaccompanied children in the wake of the disaster. Protesters, including local Belarusians, took to the streets of Ukraine's capital Sunday after a Belarusian opposition figure was detained in Minsk when his plane was grounded over a bomb threat. The opposition and Western officials denounced the incident Sunday as a hijacking operation by the Belarus government. Faces charges that could bring 15 years in prison. The flight from Athens, Greece, to the Lithuanian capital changed course and headed for Minsk. Plane was allowed to continue after several hours there. The Lithuanian president called the incident a state-sponsored terror act. A cable car taking visitors to a mountaintop view of some of northern Italy's most picturesque lakes plummeted to the ground, killing at least 14 people. A young child was also hospitalized in serious condition with broken bones. Six of the dead were Israeli citizens, including a family of four who lived in Italy. The Israeli Foreign Ministry said it wasn't clear if the other couple was related. The Stresa mayor said that it appeared that a cable broke, sending the car careening until it hit a pylon, then fell to the ground. Images from the site show the crumpled car in a clearing of a thick patch of pine trees near the summit, overlooking the lake. The Italian government announced a commission to investigate that disaster. The United States on Sunday announced visa restrictions on Ethiopian and Eritrean officials accused of fueling the six-month-old war in Ethiopia's Tigray region, saying those involved had taken no meaningful steps to end hostilities. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a statement that the people in Tigray continue to suffer human rights violations, abuses, and atrocities. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 24. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Residents of DRC's Goma will return home on Sunday following a volcanic eruption.
Men, women and children among thousands of Congolese who are crossing the border going back to their villages. They're carrying mattresses, bags containing their belongings. Some also have livestock like goats. They are determined to just live in their land.
A Nigerian army spokesperson describes as a sad day for Nigeria the crash that killed the army chief of staff. Liberia Senate addresses U.S. embassy concerns about Prince Johnson. A hearing today at the ICC concerning an alleged Sudanese war crimes perpetrator and a petition to block the candidacy of Zambian President Edgar Lungu.
They want to raise emotions in the Zambian people to make the Zambian people believe that the president is running for an illegal third term when they know that that is not the truth.
And Kenya and the international campaign to end fistula. Those stories plus Samson Omale's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. About 7,000 residents of the Democratic Republic of Congo who fled their country to neighboring Rwanda were returning home on Sunday. They fled as lava from the volcanic eruption of Mount Nyiragongo reached their homes. Yuji Uwimana filed this report from the Rwanda DRC border in Rubavu district.
Men, women and children among thousands of Congolese who are crossing the border going back to their villages. They're carrying mattresses, bags containing their belongings. Some also have livestock like goats. They are determined to just live in their land.
There's
nothing you can do. You have to go back home. The situation is that mysteriously, our volcano Nyiragongo caught fire around 7 p.m. After seeing that fire, we were all scared. We tried to take what we could and fled to Rwanda. Our neighbors here opened the border and received us well. But what happened is very catastrophic. Here on the Rwandan side, at 7 p.m., everyone was up, fearing that the fire was coming to Rwanda. In the beginning, the fire sounded like bullets. It was really scary. After receiving thousands of displaced Congolese, the Rwandan government accommodated some of them in Rubavu Stadium. Some of the wealthier displaced members took up accommodation at local hotels. Rwanda's Minister of Local Government, Jean-Marie Vianney Gatabazi, says the government remains ready to host Congolese in case the volcano erupts again. As of now, only scientists can know whether the volcano had permanently stopped erupting or if there are still other consequences for Goma residents. As far as the Rwandan government is concerned, we are on standby to receive them if they need a refuge again. The region of Goma in DRC is home to two active volcanoes, Nyamulagira and Nyiragongo. The last time a major Nyiragongo eruption occurred was in 2002, when about 250 people were killed and 120,000 others were left homeless. The eruption of Nyiragongo is like its previous one. Authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo said other districts of the Goma city were not in danger as the lava was unlikely to reach those areas. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Rubavu, Western Rwanda.
A spokesperson for the Nigerian Air Force says the crash of a military aircraft last Friday evening that killed Chief of Army Staff Lieutenant General Ibrahim Atahiru and other senior army officers marked a sad day for the Nigerian armed forces and the country as a whole. There have been calls for a thorough investigation into what caused the crash, but Air Commodore Edward Gapquet, Director of Public Relations and Information of the Nigerian Air Force, said the crash will have no impact on the army's determination to defeat the terrorist group Boko Haram.
It's sad day for our country, it's sad day for the Nigerian forces.
There have been too many military air crashes, and I'm wondering what does this mean for the fight against Boko Haram?
I disagree with you. You said there have been too many military crashes. I disagree with you entirely. Because what is too many to you? In the United States of America, for instance, I can give you statistics. In the last 7 years, there have been 200 military plane crashes. Can you compare that to what is happening here? Average in the last 5 years, they have had an average of about 35 military plane crashes yearly, average per year. So what is this? This is nothing as far as we're concerned. In any case, if you want only an active Air Force that experiences plane crashes. You don't expect to hear military plane crashes in African countries, for instance, that don't even have an Air Force or don't have an active Air Force. So I don't think it's too much. It's just an unfortunate situation that we've had these types of loot, and that's just it. There's nothing too much about it.
So, as I was saying, what does this mean in terms of the fight against Boko Haram?
The lost leadership of the army staff, but the Nigerian army continues. The Nigerian armed forces continue to forge ahead. That will not deter any member of the armed forces in fulfilling our constitutional mandate. So, it's a sad situation, but why not? We will continue to do and put in our best in defense of our country and securing our people so they can go about living their lives and going about their normal futures.
Air Commodore Edward Gapquid is the Director of Public Relations and Information of the Nigerian Air Force. The Liberian Senate has responded to the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia concerning the election of Senator Prince Johnson as chair of the Senate Committee on Defense, Intelligence, and National Security. In a statement last week, the embassy expressed a disappointment in Johnson's election because of the role he allegedly played in the Liberian Civil War. Moses Gaziewu reports from Monrovia.
In a statement issued late Friday, the Senate assured what it called Liberia's partners and friendly nations that it does not support the commission of war crimes and violation of human rights. The Senate further said it was seeking the best diplomatic means to meet with the U.S. Embassy to better understand the embassy's concerns relating to Senator Prince Johnson. The former leader of the Independent Patriotic Front of Liberia rebel group was elected unopposed to head the committee with oversight on national security. Lofa County Senator Steve Zago withdrew his name from the race last minute to hand Prince Johnson the slot. Steven Zago said Prince Johnson is an influential figure in the Liberian Senate and did not want to stall his victory.
And I knew that if I is a contestant, I would not have beaten Prince Johnson because the stage had already been set. You know those who play the game to ensure that he wins. Since that committee is a very big committee, the vice chair is as powerful as the chair. Henceforth, I chose to go for that because I'm a CPP candidate. I would not have 19 vote.
Senator Zago's party accused him of accepting a bribe, but the Lofa County lawmaker has dismissed the claim.
It's unfortunate, it's unfounded. When I contested to be pro-temporary, my own political leader campaigned against me. She campaigned for Senator Abachi. So then, how can you now come and want to accuse me?
The U.S. Embassy statement labeled Senator Johnson as a notorious warlord who has resisted the establishment of a war crimes court for Liberia. But Senator Jonathan Cape of Grand Bassett says he has a question about the U.S. Embassy statement.
History has recorded in Liberia that it was the same Senator Prince Johnson, 2006, after his election, chaired the same committee. History also recorded that it was Senator Prince Johnson who was elected among his colleagues that went to ECOWAS and later on begin the vice chair. And then so by coincidence, I'm wondering, as somebody who came in the middle of 2015, I've been working with him, I think this is the strongest statement thus far that been made about his leadership role in the Senate. So it's something we need to look at.
Senator Cappy said it will be prudent that Senator Johnson give up the position.
The best evidence in the matter is Senator Johnson himself. If I were in a shoe, considering the image of the Senate, Liberia, and considering the strategic nature of statement from the U.S. Embassy. If I were in our shoe, my first thought would be to resign that position and continue my service to the Liberian people.
Over 50 members of the House of Representatives are believed to have signed a resolution for a bill to establish a war crimes court for Liberia to establish accountability for crimes committed during the Liberian Civil War. Moses Gazel, VOA News, Monrovia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 24.
The International Criminal Court, the ICC, will hold the first of major hearings in the case of Ali Kouché today, Monday, in The Hague. Kouché, a leader of the Janjaweed militia in Darfur, is charged with 50 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes for his alleged responsibility for rapes, destruction of property, and killing of civilians in four villages in West Darfur in 2003 and 2004. Elise Kepler is the Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She says the purpose of Monday's hearings is for the ICC judges to assess if there's enough evidence for the case to go to trial.
Ali Khashoggi is a Janjaweed leader, and he's the first suspect to come into the custody of the International Criminal Court, who faces charges for crimes in Darfur, crimes against humanity, and war crimes charges for atrocities committed in West Darfur in 2003 and 2004. So it's a big development in advancing justice that at long last, there's progress in any of the Darfur cases, which have been outstanding for so long. And what the hearings themselves are, it's called the confirmation of charges hearings. And the hearings are the moment for the judges to assess if the prosecutor has adequate evidence for the case to go to trial.
These are the same charges involving the former president, Omar al-Bashir. Is that correct?
That's correct. Very similar, although Bashir is also subject to charges of genocide in addition to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
As you know, Elise, these days there is an argument that African courts can and should be able to handle their own legal issues, as we saw in the case of former Chadian president Issen Habre.
Absolutely, where national courts can and are willing to prosecute, they should. National courts are the first line of defense in trying serious crimes. But we have a situation here in which, though the Sudanese authorities have said they're committed to accountability, it's been 18 months and these individuals are in custody and there are no charges against them relating to Darfur crimes. So they are also under an express legal obligation imposed by the UN Security Council when the Council, back in 2005, asked the ICC to take up this investigation.
There's talk in Liberia now about the establishment of a war crimes court. Looking at Sudan, these alleged crimes were committed 2003, 2004. The argument being made in Liberia by some people is that why not let bygones be bygones for the sake of peace?
Do you think the victim has forgotten what's happened? In fact, I was in Liberia in 2018 as Momentum clamoring for a war crimes court has come up. And people are clear that they feel the country needs justice to move forward. And we've seen again and again that there are always these claims like, oh, trials will destabilize the country that's like precious stability. But in fact, what we see is that lack of accountability, lack of trials tends to fuel further conflict and violence. And in fact, we're seeing that in Sudan right now, whereas justice really reinforces respect for rule of law and rights.
Elise, thank you very much. Always nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Take good care.
Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with us from New York. A spokesperson for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party, the PF, says those challenging the legality of President Edgar Lungu's candidacy for the August 12th presidential election are doing so because they know they cannot defeat him at the ballot. Linda Kasonde, former president of the Law Association of Zambia, and Lusaka lawyer John Sangwa have petitioned the Constitutional Court to disqualify President Lungu because they said his candidacy is a third term. Patriotic Front Party media director Antonio Mwanza says the courts have already settled the issue of the legality of President Lungu's candidacy. He said those seeking another court intervention are doing so on behalf of main opposition candidate Hakainde Hichilema.
The issue of the legitimacy of President Edgar Chabalungu has been dealt with conclusively by the Constitutional Court, which has got the authority to interpret the Constitution of the Republic of Zambia. In 2016, a case was brought before the Constitutional Court in what is called the Dani-Pule case, because Mr. Dani-Pule was the major person who raised the issues before the court, and the court ruled that His Excellency the President is eligible to run for the 2021 general election. On Friday, the 17th of May, 2021, the Constitutional Court again pronounced itself that His Excellency President Edgar Chabalungu is eligible to contest the 2021 elections.
So, Antonio, the petitioners, Ms. Kasonde and Mr. Sangwa, their argument is that President Lungu has already served two terms and that running in the August election is a third term for him. Your comment?
The Constitutional Court ruled in its judgment of 2016, in the case that was brought in 2016, that holding office is tied to a term of office. That if a person has not served a term of office, then he has not held office. And President Lungu, when he became president in his 2015, January 25 to 13th of September in 2016, he only served for 1 year, 6 months. And according to the ruling of the Constitutional Court, a term of office is a period running for 3 years to 5 years. Anything less than 3 years is not considered as a term of office. And if it is not considered as a term of office, then you have not held office. And they ruled, therefore, that the president has not held office and has not served the term of office, and therefore is eligible.
So, Antonio, if, as you said, this has been handled by the court, why do you think it is coming up now?
It's coming up for two specific reasons. Number one is for political reasons, because Mr. John Sangwa and his team and all the surrogates are working as surrogates for the UPND, the United Party for National Development, our major opponent in this election. And they want to raise emotions in the Zambian people to make the Zambian people believe that the president is running for an illegal third term when they know that that is not the truth. The whole idea is that they are afraid to face His Excellency President Edgar Chabalungu at the ballot because they know that they cannot beat him on the ballot.
Antonio, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Antonio Mwansa is the media director for the ruling Patriotic Front Party of Zambia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. More than 3 million women suffer from obstetric fistula in sub-Saharan Africa due to poorly resourced healthcare systems. According to the World Health Organization, at least 500,000 women and girls live with the condition in poor countries. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, at least 3,000 Kenyan women are affected by obstetric fistula yearly.
May 23rd is the United Nations International Day to End Obstetric Fistula, a hole in the birth canal caused by protracted and obstructed labor. In Kenya, women and girls do not report to the facilities on time for the fear of discrimination. Sharon Kurir is an advocate of the High Court of Kenya. She suffered obstetric fistula after delivering her second-born son.
Labored for too long, so I got tired, my muscles got tired, baby came out forcefully, completely tore my vaginal lining to the rectum, and there was a hole. So I realized that my muscles weren't going well since I couldn't hold urine and I couldn't hold fecal matter. And at the same time, there was a smell. At that time, I didn't know who I could reach out to say that, you know what, I'm smelling. In Africa, we live in a cultural society where matters, sexuality is not talked about. It's a taboo.
Sharon says obstetric fistula is so traumatic and the healing process was not easy for her.
The challenges are intense because there's discrimination. There's the stigma that comes along. You know, they think that you're smelling urine because you're dirty. They think that you're smelling urine and feces because you're unkempt and clumsy after delivery. I isolated myself totally. I didn't want anybody in my space. I didn't want anybody to come close to me because I was smelling, and I was smelling really badly.
Medical specialists say young bodies not ready for pregnancy and childbirth in the case of child marriage and intended pregnancy are vulnerable to the condition. Victoria Wanjiru gave birth at the age of 19. The doctor who attended to her during delivery refused to attend to her when internal organs popped out a few days after giving birth, leading to serious fistula formation.
I basically had to push the organs back in with my hands then went back to the hospital that I delivered in, and apparently the doctor said that he cannot examine me. He referred me to a different hospital by word of mouth. So I requested the nurse to talk to the doctor if he could at least write me a referral letter to that hospital so that when I get there, I don't have to queue.
Dr. Charlotte Pole, a urogynecology and pelvis floor surgeon at Kenyatta University Hospital, Kenya, says women who suffer from obstetric fistula face a lot of stigma in the society.
Women who sustain fistulas usually become ostracized. There's so much stigma. In many communities, it is believed that these women were promiscuous or that they have done something wrong to even end up with a fistula, and they're kicked out of their homesteads. Some communities, they have to live on their own because they are cursed.
Dr. Pole says women who have babies before their pelvis mature are highly affected with the condition.
Other women who would be likely to be affected by fistula are, say, those young girls who have babies before their pelvis are mature. Well, the pelvis usually matures at around the age of 18.
With this year's theme being Women's Rights Are Human Rights and Fistula Now, the United Nations Population Fund says the injury can be prevented by reproductive health care, family planning, skilled birth attendants, and emergency obstetric care. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with a look at the semi-final qualifiers for the 2020-2021 CAF Champions League. Defending champions Al-Hakli qualified for the semi-finals of the Total CAF Champions League for the fourth time in 5 years with a 3-1 aggregate win over Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa. Al-Hakli played a 1-1 draw with the South Africans in the second leg in Pretoria on Saturday to continue their journey of defending their precious title. Mamelodi Sundowns head coach Mankwoba Mnisi said they knew it was going to be a tough match.
We knew it was not going to be easy, but I think we also made it a little bit more difficult by conceding from that set piece. We tried very hard to push them. They were sitting with a very low block, which we tried to break down. Unfortunately, when we conceded from that corner kick, which I think we did not do very well in our zones, El Sulaya came and flicked it behind and created problems for us.
Al-Hakli coach Pitso Mosamane, who eliminated his former employers in his first competitive return to South Africa, was reduced to tears at the post-match conference as he revealed how he was on the receiving end of insults hurled at him from South African supporters just before the match.
I was a little bit emotional only when I saw the placards outside. Then they stopped the bus and all these people swearing at me, swearing at my mother. I said to myself, what else should I have done for this team to get the respect? But it's football, I understand. And I know the person who did that. I know the person who's behind that. Just bitter because I left. The things I've received before I came, before my match from South Africa, if I show you my phone and I show you my things, correspondences I've received, emails I've received, they just don't let me go.
In a dramatic qualification scenario, Osporan Sportive de Tunis turned a first-leg defeat into a penalty shootout win to secure their berth in the semi-finals and set up a mouth-watering clash with Egyptian giant Al-Hakli. Meanwhile, Simba of Tanzania claimed a huge 3-0 victory over Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa, but it wasn't enough for qualification since they had endured a thumping 4-0 defeat in the first leg. Simba SC Tanzania's coach Didier Gomez da Rosa says his men gave their very best.
I'm very, very proud of my player because they fight, they didn't give up, they try until the end, but they are show very, very good spirit, very good fighting spirit. They were very committed, and Really, I'm very, very proud to be the coach of this kind of player.
Despite the loss, Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa have found their way into the competition semi-final for the first time in the club's history. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ray Kish Triak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.